It is week 24 of the year 2020, and you're listening to Father Roderick to the Max. Hey, welcome back to another episode of Father Roderick to the Max, the show that I record exclusively for my monthly supporters. Most of you are patrons, some of you are supporting me through other means, but I want to thank you again for your ongoing support and also for your feedback. I really learn a lot from your ideas. It gives me ideas and it also helps me sometimes to troubleshoot. Like the other day, there was a problem with the feed and one of the podcasts didn't show up, and I noticed it because one of you posted it on Patreon, and I get those messages right away. So we were able to fix it quite quickly. That had to do, by the way, with the new website that we've been able to build. And in case you're wondering, what do I do with your contributions? Well, this new website has cost me a couple of thousand euros. It was expensive, but worth it. I've been wanting to create a new website dedicated to all my content and kind of bring it together for easy consumption. Almost on a weekly basis, I get 20, 30, 40 new followers, mostly on YouTube. And they have no idea that I've been doing podcasting for, I don't know how many years, 15 years, more than that, that I've done documentaries, that I've been doing live streams. So I wanted a place for new people to send them to. Just say, go to fatherroderick.com and just check out what is there and subscribe to what you like. And, building a website, a simple website, it's something that I can do. But in this case, I wanted to create something that looks a bit more like one of the bigger video on demand platforms like Netflix or Disney Plus or Prime Video. And so that's how we came up with this particular layout, which is custom made. So you can imagine that they spent a lot of time on developing that website in conjunction with me. Of course, I had to give indications on what I wanted, how I wanted it to look like. I did some of the graphics myself. But I am so happy because this website is going to be the hub for not just a podcast, but also live streams and also for future projects. And it is extremely versatile. And I have the company that made it, Webheld, on retainer. So in case there needs to be something needs to be improved or something, I don't have to do it myself. I don't have to ask Inge to do that technical stuff. They also take care of the hosting, the updating of the server, etc. Well, I wouldn't have been able to build that website if it weren't for your monthly support. So again, thank you so much for your help. Let's dive into the kitchen. The other day, I got one of those magic bags from a service called Too Good To Go. I think I've explained the concept. It's an app you install on your mobile phone. It looks at where you live, and then it looks at a list of shops that will put mostly food that is nearing the expiration date. They put some of that stuff in a bag, and then you buy it for a couple of bucks. Mostly it's about 5 euros, but you get usually about 15 euros worth of food. The only downside is you don't know what you get, and it is food that is sold or to you on the expiration date. It's food that they would otherwise throw away. So it is actually a very good initiative, good because it saves me money, and good because it means that the food does not get thrown away. It does require me to immediately work with the ingredients. I cannot leave them in the fridge for a couple of days because they will go bad. And you don't know what you get. So in this case, there was a big bag of onions, like half a kilo of onions. And, well, I often cook with onions. But in this case, I know that if you open a bag like that, and they were pre-cut. They were not, I mean, I have my own reserve of onions, but these were all nicely cut and just regular white onion. That is not easy to use in my regular cooking. So the first thing that struck me is like, I'm going to make onion soup, French onion soup. I have fond memories of French onion soup from the time that I was young. We went to France oftentimes on vacation, and in a lot of restaurants, we would just get what the French eat, and onion soup was one of my favorite first meals, or how would you call that when you have like several servings. Anyway, what I liked about the onion soup was it was kind of weird because I did not like onions as a kid. Most kids don't like onions. So making soup of onions, that sounded kind of gross. But then it always came in this terracotta bowl. It was piping hot. And there would always be a piece of bread, French bread, on top of that, floating as an island in this brown, gooey soup. And it would be covered with molten cheese. And it was and it was already like half soaked by the onion soup. And that was, for me, the best element of the French onion soup. It was that piece of French toast with nice Gruyere or whatever cheese they would melt on top of it. They would put these terracotta bowls in the oven for a while so that it would get nice and crispy and bubbly. And that whole combination of this is a soup unlike any other soup that we would eat at home, always has been kind of nostalgic. And well, this segment I've talked a lot about nostalgic food, but this is one of those recipes that I associate with vacation, with being in France, and I miss being elsewhere. I miss traveling. I miss going to Rome. I miss going to France. I'm not even sure that I will be able to travel this year because of the corona situation, and not every country has corona under control. If you only look at the United States, there are still a number of states where the R2 factor is the measure that is used to see how fast the virus is growing for how many. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. For 15 states in the United States, that number is above 1, which means that the virus is still increasing. It is expanding. Fortunately, the majority of the states have that under number 1. Here in the Netherlands, it is slowly creeping upwards again, which is very worrying because they have just loosened the restrictions. And so have a number of other countries that surround us. So there is a possibility to go to certain countries on vacation, and France is one of them. But if this number goes above 1 again, it means that you get a situation where it can multiply very quickly. And so my fear is that there will be new restrictions. The reason, of course, is that people are starting to, you know, lose awareness and are not as prudent as they used to be. So just in case we're all going to be stuck at home for this, for the upcoming months, it is a possibility, it's a real possibility, then this recipe may at least taste like vacation in France. It is very simple to make. You just need onions. And what is vital for the ingredient is that you don't throw the onions in the stock or whatever. You can use beef stock or vegetable stock for it. It just depends. The stock is very important for the taste, but what really I think is essential for good onion soup is that you caramelize the onions, which means you put them in a pan, and in this case I used a slightly bigger pan because it was 0.5 kilo. You add some sugar to it and some butter or oil. And then you let it simmer and you let it brown. If you add a bit of sugar, it helps the process of caramelization. And so you take about 10 minutes, depends on the quantity of onions, until they're nice golden brown. That brown color is showing you that the caramelization has taken place. And of course, it will get a lot more flavor than if you just dump raw onions in a bowl of stock. So once you've caramelized the onions, the deeper the color of the onions are, the more flavor it will give your soup. So once you've caramelized the onions, 10, 15 minutes, add some more sugar, maybe a teaspoon of salt, and you can add some garlic. This is optional. It's not necessary. I didn't use it myself, but garlic, it's just all adding complexity to the taste. And then you deglaze it with vermouth or white wine. You can use that too. So you, because of the caramelization, of course, the bottom of your pan will start to brown and may also harden a little bit. So you add a little bit of white wine or vermouth, and then you you make sure that you get the bottom cleaned up. You scrape everything from the bottom. Of course, you do that with a wooden spoon. And then you add the stock. You can make the stock yourself. I was kind of lazy, so I just used pre-made stock. I use beef stock because I like the combination of the beef flavor with the onions. But you can also go entirely vegetable. And you can also add, if you want to really be fancy, add bay leaves and thyme. And then you let it simmer. This is, again, very important for the flavor. You want all these different flavors to mix. So you cover the pot, you lower the heat, and you leave it cooking for about 30 minutes. And then what happens is that the onions start to decompose a little bit, so it becomes easier to eat, but also easier to digest. One of the problems with onion soup sometimes, if you buy it in a restaurant, is that the onions are not cooked enough. And so that gives you digestive problems. I won't go into detail, but you know what I mean. So you don't want that. So the simmering is important for everything to kind of decompose a little bit. And then you can, yeah, of course, you have to taste it. If it needs more salt, maybe some pepper, you add that. You get rid of the bay leaves, of course. You can even add some more wine. I personally, as a child, I did not like it when they put wine in it because, well, kids don't like the taste of wine. But it does, it could help. Of course, use, some white wine, not red wine. And then the staple ingredient, you have to create the bread island, the fromage island. You toast some bread slices, preferably French bread, but you can also use just white bread and toasted. Make sure that you have the oven preheated. You brush the bread or the toast with some olive oil, and then you add the cheese. It can be Parmesan, can be Gruyere, whatever cheese. It doesn't really matter as long as it's a lot. And then you bake it. You put it in the oven until the cheese has melted, and then when you serve this in a nice bowl, preferably, of course, something that looks a bit, nice. So if you've got terracotta or something like that, use that. And then the final thing is you put the piece of bread on top of the soup and serve it immediately. Otherwise, it will sink to the bottom and the effect will be gone. I guarantee you that this is a great soup, and it's actually super cheap. You just need onion. Onions are not that expensive. A bit of bread, a bit of cheese, a bit of stock. It's all super simple. There's nothing too fancy, but it is a very specific taste, and I love this soup. So I've been eating onion soup for 3 days. That's kind of the downside of making a whole pot of soup just for myself. Yeah, well, I happen to like the onion soup, so it wasn't a problem. To dive into history. And of course, history has been on the forefront in the news and in the public debate lately because of this whole international uproar about inequality and about racism and the way in which some of our societies, people of color or any other, thing that they were born with, or identity, religion, are discriminated against and maltreated. And it's always important to remember that this is not just about people from African descent. This also happens to people from Asian descent. I've been discriminated when I was a kid because I looked Chinese. Well, yes, I'm a quarter Chinese. In this predominantly white school, that was an anomaly, and kids like anomalies. It gives them a reason to pick up on each other. So I know from experience that being picked on because you had, dark hair and my eyes looked Chinese, That's not a nice situation to be in, to put it mildly. And there was no one to who understood that. Even the teachers, I remember when I was going to complain, they didn't identify it as racism. They were just like, well, you just go shake hands. You know, you had to they forced you to shake hands with your mortal enemies, and they would just continue. But of course, what's happening right now in this, especially in North America, is much, much worse than this. And we also have to realize that a lot of discrimination happens on the basis of faith. Christians are being persecuted. Muslims are being persecuted because of their faith. None of that should be a reason to hate on other people or to give people less chances in society. So what I think is important in this discussion is also to realize that racism does not just appear like that. It often has very ancient roots in your national history. And of course, in the United States, it's becoming more and more clear how much slavery and the history of slavery in the U.S. And discrimination, like systemic discrimination, is still impacting the worldview and maybe the way some people look at others. That behavior, that sentiment of superiority comes from, you know, sometimes century old history. And the only way to fix that and to change society is to also face the dark pages of history and not wash it away, not glorify or romanticize history. That's one of the lessons that the church has learned. This whole idea that back in the olden days, the Catholic Church was so good. It was so, we should go back to the way things were. Well, that's not true. There was a lot wrong. That's you always have to be careful when people start to glamorize the past. I think that if we only go back to celebrating Mass the way it was before the changes in the 60s, then everything will be fine. Well, it's during the time that Mass was in Latin and everybody was super pious and respectful. It was in that same time frame that the abuse crisis took place, and that priests were shown to be double faced and mistreated others. And there is no history without its dark pages. And what you need, the reason that we study history and that it's so important to know your history, is that you can learn from it, and it helps you prevent the same mistakes in the future. And it can also teach you things that you may forget in the present. So that's why we have saints in the Catholic Church. They show us that despite all the flaws and all the sins of the church and God's ground personnel, there are also people that have shown in everything they did and how they lived that the ideal was also possible, that it's attainable, that the church is not just about this dream, this mirage of ideas, but that it is actually, there are examples throughout history of people that have lived the life the way God intended it. That's why we call them saints, and we're called to follow their example. When it comes to our history, of course, for the U.S., it's going to be vital to continue to talk about the effects of slavery, and it's actually quite recent history in the United States. It's something they need to face and they need to talk about, and especially schools have a very big responsibility to show history, show the facts, and not glamorize it, not romanticize it. That's same is true with sometimes the origin of our feasts. There is quite a bit of mythology around our own history. Think of something like Thanksgiving, which is very important for Americans. Now, of course, I'm not an American. I'm European, so I may not know all the ins and outs. But what I have heard is that sometimes you hear these backstories of how Thanksgiving came about, and it's this romanticized idea of that you know, the local inhabitants were celebrating together with the people that from Europe, and there's even this religious romanticizing that the Protestants that went to live in the United States, in America, that they fled Europe because of persecution. It's quite the opposite, actually. They wanted to go to America because Europe was too open. These Catholics had these Jews, they had way too much influence in society. They wanted to have something more pure. And so that has also impacted the religious history of the United States, and it still has an impact even on Catholicism. There is this Puritan, I don't know, kind of Protestant vibe sometimes to American Catholicism, where it's very black and white, very, I don't know, just un-Catholic. It's hard to explain. As a European, sometimes I'm bewildered by some of the conflicts within the Catholic Church and the attitude of some people that are sometimes more Protestant than they would care to admit. It's important to understand history, to understand your own identity, and to know where you stand in this. In the Netherlands, we have the same problem with our own history. You may have heard me talk about the Feast of St. Nicholas and how there's currently this discussion going on for years now about the helpers of St. Nicholas, which in the Netherlands are depicted as blackface. The helpers of St. Nicholas clearly resemble the caricatures of slaves. And there is this tendency in some circles to deny that, to say, well, no, of course it's not racist. We cannot be racist. We're Dutch. We're open. We don't do racism. This is just a children's feast. And they don't understand how people can be offended by people in blackface. Because it's always been like that. It's tradition. It's a children's story. All these people are trying to take away our national identity and our cultural heritage. Well, I'm thinking that is probably out of denial of our own dark pages in history. The Netherlands is a rich country because of and thanks to slavery. The Dutch were great at selling slaves and buying slaves and moving slaves and using slaves. We were great at invading other countries and rob it from their riches. We've been doing that for centuries. That is the basis of our very well-functioning economy. And I remember in school, when I was in primary school, we would never hear about slavery. We would read about these glory days, the golden ages of Dutch commerce, where we would take our boats and sail the globe and do business. And it was all framed as if we were so good at doing business. No, we were not. We were good at robbing other countries and other people from what belonged to them. We just stole it. Our gold, our spices, everything that we traded in was stuff that didn't grow in the Netherlands. We were just very good at setting up, you know, slave colonies and putting other people to work so that we could enrich ourselves. And of course, that history still has an effect on our culture today. And the depiction of the helpers of St. Nicholas in a century ago was heavily influenced by that racism, by latent racism. And of course, the blackface is racist. And are still so, also Catholics. And I know priests that are, you know, gung-ho about it. As soon as you start a discussion like this, it's like, the next thing that they're going to rob us from is our Catholic identity. It's persecution. All these people are exaggerating. It's like, dude, just consider the possibility that it can be offensive to other people. If you're a Catholic, especially if you're a priest, you're supposed to to be careful with hurting other people's feelings, even if you don't intend to hurt other people's feelings. Maybe you did not experience the Feast of St. Nicholas as racist. That is very well possible. I grew up with it. I never saw a problem in these black Petes. Now I do. I totally do. And I see how much this is linked to our own view of people of color. That is heavily impacted by the way that we've been treating people of color, especially our, you know, African slaves, for centuries. And I should know better because I've been discriminated against myself being Chinese. And when the COVID virus started to spread, we've had a couple of weeks where Chinese people from all over the Netherlands gathered to protest against being discriminated against. There were songs on the radio that were clearly discriminating it against the Chinese because it was called the Chinese virus, you know? As if the Chinese made it on purpose and relished in you know, having thousands and thousands of people die from this horrible virus. What kind of attitude is that? So it is, I'm very glad that the world seems to wake up and that there are so many of these ongoing protests all over the world. Because it shows that we are waking up. This is kind of comparable to what happened 2 years ago with the whole Me Too movement. There was also a lot of criticism of that movement. Isn't that over the top? Aren't we victimizing people and judging them before there's real proof? And is it really as bad as people say it is right now? It is a signal that something is structurally wrong, and it has led to many structural changes in our media industry, in what is acceptable. The crisis in the church, the scandals, have led to massive changes in the way that we form our priests, that we organize our parishes, that we treat people, the way we verify people that are working with children, for instance. There, even the discussion about celibacy has been very much impacted, I think, and for a very good reason, by all the scandals. This uprising, the anger of almost an entire society against the Catholic Church, the hypocrisism of the Catholic Church that preaches strict morals on the one hand, and the same people that are most gung-ho about those principles are the one that are betraying those principles in their own personal lives because they think it's, you know, it doesn't count for them. They are the exception to the rule. It's just like the Pharisees did in the time of Jesus. Nothing has changed. But those protests also led to a lot of unrest, and I know so many Catholics that were fed up with it. Well, I didn't do anything wrong. Why is society making it seem as if, well, if you're a Catholic, then you're an abuser? That is not true. That is not right. Well, the thing is, it is just like in this case. Not everyone who is white is a racist. Of course not. But these protests come from anger. Anger comes from things that you value and you want to protect. And in this case, it's the dignity of every human being. It is this deep-rooted conviction that we were born with, that we are all children of God. We are made to the image of God, which means we have this conscience that tells us what is right and what is wrong, and how we should treat each other. And when we fight, even when we do that as children, we do feel guilty about it. But if you continue to do that, and it is even encouraged by the culture that you live in or by your parents, if you have been taught to hate on other people or to fear other people because they look different or they believe different things than you believe, they smell weird, they eat strange things, that can break your conscience, that can misinform your conscience so that you stop treating other people as if they were your brothers and sisters. That is why the message of Jesus is so important in this whole discussion. He teaches his disciples the Our Father. If you pray, say Our Father. that it's not just saying something about God, it's also saying something about us. If we call God our Father, it means that everyone who prays addresses the same Father, and it means that we are all family. That is why the most important prayer in Christianity is the Our Father. It is such a vital message. So how can you be a Catholic? How can you be a Christian and have these racist feelings? Or how can you wave away criticism when people feel offended? You should take it seriously. You should feel pain when someone else feels pain. We're supposed to suffer with the people that feel oppressed. No matter what you think, their pain is real. Otherwise, they wouldn't protest. They wouldn't express their anger. Anger always comes from hurt. So that is why it is important to talk about history from time to time.
I'm quite keen on comic books, especially the ones about superheroes. I find the whole mythology surrounding superheroes fascinating.
You ever try these comics?
No.
You know something?
No, what?
You read too many comic books.
I read another Star Wars comic on Marvel Unlimited, and it's a whole series that I missed somehow, but it's awesome. It's really good. Artwork is great, and it gives extra depth to the characters that we know from the sequels. Not everyone is a fan of the sequels, of course. I happen to be one. But it's always interesting to see more of the backstory of the characters that feature in these, you know, most important stories in the Star Wars universe, which are the movies, the big movies. So this series was published in 2019, and every comic book talks, it gives a bit of backstory of major characters, and it's a huge list. Starts with Darth Vader, you've got one about Grand Moff Tarkin, Jabba the Hutt, Lando, Princess Leia, Anakin, General Grievous, Captain Phasma, Finn, General Hux, Kylo Ren, Poe Dameron, Rey, Rose Tico, Supreme Leader Snoke. You don't learn too much about him. And we only know the real deal about Snoke in, of course, The Rise of Skywalker, but still interesting. See a little bit more of the backstory. Boba Fett, Han Solo, Luke Skywalker, Count Dooku, Darth Maul, Jango Fett, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Padme Amidala, and Qui-Gon Jinn. It's called Star Wars Age of the Republic, or Age of... Actually, it's you've got three different types. You've got Age of Resistance, which is about characters featuring in the sequels. Then you've got Age of Rebellion, that, of course, is all about the original trilogy, and Age of the Republic, where it goes back to the prequel era. These are all done very, very well. I was most curious about stories of Poe Dameron and Captain Phasma and Rose Tico, and also Hux. Hux is used a lot, especially in The Last Jedi, as comedic, like a comic relief. Which I don't think worked very well. I mean, it was funny, that whole intro to his character in The Last Jedi. I thought was funny because it played well with Poe Dameron. But it also took away a little bit of the dramatic side, of the kind of the serious side of that character, who is in The Force Awakens presented to us almost like a Nazi. And I was glad that in the last movie, some of that seriousness to his character was brought back by J.J. Abrams. What I liked about this comic book is that it tells a story about Hux going on a mission with Kylo Ren. And Kylo has to save Hux at one point. And at the same time, these two really don't trust each other. So it uses this dynamic of rivalry almost, especially in their relationship to Snoke. They both want the power. They both don't trust the other because, well, dark forces always feel that others are a menace instead of an ally. The dark side cannot think in terms of allies. It's always about a rivalry, because ultimately there can only be two, and of those two there can only be one. So the teacher always has to kill the master, and then the pupil kills the teacher, and then the pupil becomes the master, and then gets another apprentice, and the apprentice kills the master, and it's this ongoing cycle of not being able to live with one another. The opposite of the rebellion, the opposite of where friendship is what helps them overcome this much more powerful empire, but because the empire is, or the new order is egotistical and does not share power, does not share wealth, that is why it ultimately crumbles, and friendship proves to be so much more powerful. Anyways, that's very well done. What I liked about this comic book is that it also shows you a glimpse of the origin of General Hux. It turns out that he was a bastard child of an Admiral Hux, I think, who slept with a kitchen maid and then fathered this child that he used almost as a slave. And one of the things that General Hux remembers of his father is that his father always told him that he was weak. You're weak. And humiliated him. And that is, I think, very interesting information, or helpful information, to understand why he is so anxious in these three movies. He's always, there is still that child that thinks that he's not good enough, and constantly wants to prove himself, and wants to win, and wants to eliminate his enemies. He wants to be on top of things, because otherwise it could be taken away from him, just like his father took away his dignity. So it shows you how damaged Hux was as a child, and how much that has impacted his behavior in the story of the movies. I also think that what is brilliant about that little bit of backstory is that when Snoke calls him weak, and Kylo does the same, it triggers huge pain. It triggers that trauma, which shows you, when you see Hux, and I think he's been played very well, you see this he's always in a cramp. He's always, he projects this kind of steel behavior, like, I'm invincible, I'm evil, but it's all a pose, because on the inside there is someone, and there's still this child that is extremely insecure and is always afraid that life will be taken away from him, or opportunities will be taken away from him, because he's not good enough. He's a bastard child. So I thought it was very, very well done in this comic book series. So again, it's called Star Wars Age of Resistance, General Hux, published in 2019. And now it is time for a new segment, and I created a special jingle for it. This is the segment about liturgy. This segment, I always explain some stuff pertaining to the liturgy. It's a bit similar to the Peculiar Bunch segment on my weekly regular show for everyone. This one is a little bit more specific and deals with the symbolism in Catholic liturgy. And today I want to talk about something that was in the news yesterday, where a priest has closed down one of his churches because it was desecrated. Now, that is not happening a lot. It seems to happen more often in my diocese for some reason. And maybe it has to do with the size of our current parishes, which usually consist of many former parishes that were bundled into one mega parish. And every mega parish has a pastoral team with one priest who is in charge. It's the same here. There's one pastor, and he's in charge of what used to be almost 20 separate parishes. And, of course, that it was not so long ago. It's just 20 years ago when they all had their own, councils, and they were used to doing whatever they wanted. And now there is one priest who is responsible for all of them. And of course, that is very difficult because you can't micromanage in these situations. You have to manage things on, the broad strokes and have confidence in the people, in the local people. Well, turns out that in one of these smaller villages, Lievelde, the lay people that were kind of managing that church location, they had heard about an alternative feast day to replace the local fair. So every year there would be this fair, people would come out, it would be good for the local economy, it would be just a fun event with music and all sorts of games for the children and a concert. And all of that, of course, because of COVID-19, was cancelled. And so the local committee, the local feast committee, came up with this idea, well, let's do something that people can watch on a live stream, and we'll just do we'll still do the concerts, we'll still do the music and cabaret and whatnot, stand-up comedy, but we'll do it in a number of locations in our town. Well, you already guess what happened. They also chose the local Catholic church as one of the stages for especially a musical evening with pop music. There was a DJ. I mean, it wasn't anything too shocking, but it was secular music. And they used an impressive light show to transform that kind of middle-of-the-road church into what looked like a pop podium. And they streamed the whole thing, thinking that, well, that's for the village. What they did not realize was that if you stream anything on YouTube, the whole world can watch it. So before you knew it, the priest, pastor, got wind of this and realized this is way beyond what you can do in a church. This is sacrilegious. There was one DJ who was playing his music was kind of this electronic music, heavy thumping bass and everything, right in front of the organ, and it was so the wrong thing to do and lack of taste. I mean, it did shock me. I'm not easily shocked, but there was this pop band, and they were like the guy who was closest to the camera, to the live stream camera. He was playing the keyboard, and there was like a bottle of beer, and they were all on the altar. So you could even see the tabernacle in the background. They didn't hide it behind a curtain or something like that. This was clearly a church that was still in use, and they used it as a pop podium. Well, the pastor, of course, I think was contacted by the diocese, and he decided to close the church, and now it has to be re-consecrated. There is a ritual for that. And before it can be used again for Catholic worship. And of course, as you can imagine, local press was reporting about it and interviewed the villagers, and they were all like, well, what's the problem? We all enjoyed this. This is a community-based thing, and why is the church doing, it's so harsh and over the top, and it's another proof that a church doesn't go with the times and doesn't care for people. And I'm reading this. It's textbook, and there should be a textbook for reacting to this and explaining. And so at the end of the article, of course, they contacted the diocese, and they say, well, you can't do just everything in a church. A church is, in Catholic tradition, is a sacred building. It's meant for worship, and everything that you do in that building has to somehow relate to worship. It's not just an open space that you can just turn into a place for liturgy during the weekend, and then during the week you can do whatever you want in it. No, that's not how it works in the Catholic Church. It has to do ultimately with theology, where we believe that the tabernacle is where we
store the consecrated hosts, the presence of Christ, the real presence of Christ. We light a candle, a lamp that is burning day and night, just like the oil lamp in the tent of the covenant. And it shows that God is always there, even if people are not always there. And I think that is a awareness that has disappeared quite a bit in the experience of the faithful, let alone the non-faithful. They think it's just a nice building, you know. We can spice it up with a laser show, and then we can give a concert there. And that was just done in poor taste. The local committee that gave permission for the church to be used as a pop podium did not even realize that they did something wrong. They did not inform the priest who was in charge. They didn't consult him. And so, of course, the priest had to act. And if he hadn't acted, the diocese would have acted. So, but it's all unfortunate. This all has to do, I think, with forming people and telling them that is what I've been working so hard on for the past 10 weeks here in this church, in St. Joseph's Church, that we use for streaming. Constantly reminding people, this is a sacred building. And so you have to clean it. It has to look a certain way. There's a symbolism in everything you do. Everything you see should have a reason to be there. And if it's just junk and someone just put it there because they didn't want to clean it up, then you have to get rid of it. And I was very strict because I was also aware that everything we showed on camera was in theory, could be watched by anyone. And what the last thing you want is in these corona times to offend or to trigger a reaction like, oh, that's why I was so strict about the liturgy. I've been, you know, fighting with people about certain things that they wanted to introduce in these live stream masses. And I was like, no, we can't. That is not according to the Roman Missal if you do that. So it's going to be all over the planet in theory. So our liturgy is going to be to the book. We'll follow the prescriptions to the letter because we have an exemplary function. And I also believe that the rules in the church are not just, you know, indications that you can discard if you like it. No, this is our common language. There are rules to grammar, there are rules to language, spelling, all of that, because it's a common contract. And that's the same with the rules in the church. It's a contract that we have with each other, that we belong to each other, that we speak the same language, that our worship is open to anyone. And if you particularize it too much, then you are no longer welcoming people from other churches because you don't speak the same language anymore. So, and I think that this has been so underestimated for years and years and years, maybe decades. So it will take a number of years to bring that awareness back. I've seen it in Church of the Holy Cross, where I was nominated years ago. When I came there, I couldn't believe my eyes. I was like, there was so much wrong with that liturgy. People were so entitled on you know, the liturgy was theirs. It was a form of expression of the local community. That's why all these local churches always emphasize how important it is that they keep their own identity. And I'm thinking, well, what identity? Our identity is that we are followers of Christ. We belong to each other. We're Catholic. We belong to a universal church. So what is this? Why do you think that is a threat to your identity? It that is what your identity consists of. And it took years to change that, bit by bit, with a lot of patience and a lot of frustration. But ultimately, I think we managed to do it. And if you look at how liturgy is celebrated there now compared to when I first arrived there, and it's not just me. I did work hard to make those changes, but I wasn't the only one. I think I'm very proud of them, and I've also seen how much it has enhanced the prayer life in that parish, and how much from a very superficial self-expression church that changed into a real place of worship, where people pray, where they come to church even before, you know, like half an hour before Mass, just to pray, light a candle. There are always people in the chapel, always praying. There were people asking for Eucharistic adoration. I could never have imagined that 15 years ago. So it goes to show that there it's something we need to continue to work on, and it's often forgotten because we're so worried about our survival with the decline of Christianity in our countries, that we tend to forget that the only way to have a future is to make that future and to form people and to teach them about faith. There is a very, very strong discipleship in Christianity in general and also in the Catholic Church. But we've forgotten it. We think that we can just make our own rules and we know better. Because everything that's old-fashioned, of course, has to be discarded. Well, no, there was wisdom in the past. There is wisdom in history. You should honor it. You should study it. You should learn from it. And then, of course, you should always also reform it and improve it and shape it to the language that is used nowadays. But that doesn't mean that you have to just use secular music and everything and secular expressions because that will destroy your own language and your own identity. It was a very difficult experience, I guess, for that local parish. And it is definitely hurting the image, or it's kind of re-emphasizing the idea that people have of the Catholic Church nowadays in my country, that it is way too old-fashioned, behind the times, too strict, reductive. And I think in our communication we need to constantly emphasize that this is because we're protecting something that is sacred and valuable. And there's even just a cultural value to a church building. Even if you don't believe, you can still understand that in a museum, you're not going to play hard rock music either, right? Or in a library, you're not going to walk around in your pajamas or something like that. There is a certain dignity to even our secular buildings. You know, you won't go to a courtroom in your t-shirt, at least not in my country. You dress up. You dress up when you go to church. It's important because that way you express what you believe, and clothes do change how you feel about things and how you behave. And, well, forms matter. Forms matter. And at the end of the show, it is time for my media review. And today I want to talk about one very important event and one thing that has been around for a while, but I recently discovered it and I love it and I want to share it with you. Let me start with the latter. I discovered a podcast that is called The Office Ladies. It's not what you think. This is not about office life. This is not about female workers in an office. No, this is about the show, The Office. The podcast is hosted by Jenna Fisher and Angela Kinsey. Of course, you remember those as Pam Beasley and Angela Martin in the American version of the sitcom The Office. They have been signed to cover the first two seasons of The Office, and they started podcasting in October 2019. And every week, they go over one of those episodes and discuss it in detail and also tell us a lot of backstories about how those episodes were made, how they were written, the stuff that they didn't use, the improvising that was going on, the little stories of the life of all the actors there. And it is fascinating. It is so cool. These two actors are very good friends in real life. They were kind of enemies or frenemies in the series, but Jenna and Angela are very good friends, and so the chemistry between these two on the show is amazing on the podcast, and they're both good storytellers, and they will take the time to go and call the producer and the cameraman and the fellow actors in case they don't remember something or they want to know something. Well, why did you improvise this line? They will just go and call them up and ask them and then relate it in the podcast. It is really fascinating stuff, and it is a joy to listen to the podcast and go back and rewatch that episode. It's like DVD commentary. I love that on DVDs and Blu-rays. It's one of the reasons that I will still continue to buy Blu-rays, even though I have most of the movies also on streaming platforms. It's the kind of backstory, the creative backstory of these beloved series that I find so fascinating. So I would recommend this uh, tremendously. If you're a fan of The Office, go listen to Office Ladies. Just Google that, Office Ladies. And they've done, I think, 31 episodes right now. So it's you're going to be busy for a while. And hopefully they will continue after two seasons. I guess the more people listen, the more chance there is that they will cover the entire series for years to come. The second thing that I wanted to talk about is the launch, or at least the first public presentation, of the PlayStation 5, the successor to the tremendously successful PlayStation 4, which in itself was the successor to the PlayStation 3, PlayStation 2, PlayStation 1. Most of us have, at one point or another in our lives, played on the PlayStation. The big competition has always been, or has been for a while, the Xbox. And Microsoft, of course, is competing with Sony to take a piece of the market. For the PlayStation 4, they dominated the market. And I think that was also partially due to the fact that Microsoft made a mistake when they launched the Xbox at first. They wanted it to be everything, not just a gaming console, but also a digital recorder and a Blu-ray player. And they were the social media hub and whatnot. And so it all became very fuzzy. Plus, the Xbox, the original Xbox One, was a little bit less spec'd compared to the PlayStation. PlayStation was slightly more powerful, not that much, but a little bit. But in the meantime, of course, Microsoft has been course correcting with the Xbox. They have been quite successful, especially in North America. It's still a very, very popular console. In the rest of the world, PlayStation dominates. But what I think what Microsoft did very well is to make the Xbox backwards compatible. So even the original Xbox games can still be played on newer iterations of the Xbox, which means that if you invest in a gaming library, you can still play all your old games, even if you buy a newer version. Sony has not done that. They did make newer versions of some of the classic games, but you had to buy them again, which, of course, makes them more money, but is also, well, potentially an obstacle to quick adoption of a newer version. They didn't leak much about the PlayStation 5. We didn't even know what it would look like. And yesterday evening, they showed us a whole bunch of trailers, mostly of games that were made exclusively for the PlayStation 5. And a lot of it looked very, very cool. I joined one of my followers on YouTube. He had did a live stream commentary of the Sony presentation. I had had a very tough day. I was very tired, so I just wanted to relax. And so I just joined the audio stream and commented on what I saw. And I liked a lot of what I saw. I wasn't blown away. There were a few games that looked really cool. But it was also just a good continuation of stuff that's already out there. I remember a few games that stood out. One was a sequel to a very popular Spider-Man game that came out only last year, I think. And this new Spider-Man game is based on the character of Miles Morales, which we know from the Spider-Verse, of course. That is going to make a lot of Spider-Man fans super happy. It looked great. Most of it was still kind of maybe not pre-rendered, but definitely cinematic scenes. I also remember another game that I really liked, and that is the sequel to Horizon. Was it Horizon Event? Let me look that up. PlayStation 5 Horizon. It's a Horizon Zero. Sorry about that. It's made by a company called Guerrilla. They've been producing games for the PlayStation for many years. And nobody expected them to show the sequel to Horizon Zero Dawn during this hardware or this first glimpse of the PlayStation 5. The trailer looks amazing. I loved the first game. I bought it for the PlayStation 4 when I still had it. And I also follow a number of these guys, of the producers, because they're Dutch, on Twitter, and have interacted with them a little bit. I'm a huge fan of what they do. And it tells the story of this girl, this young woman who lives on a planet with monsters that are just big robots. And of course, she needs to survive. It has a very distinct, realistic art style. The worlds look fantastic. A little bit like some of the Final Fantasy worlds by Square Enix. Slightly different, slightly more European in a certain way. I don't know how, but there is something European about the whole vibe of that game. And the trailer for Horizon Zero Dawn 2 Forbidden West was a real masterpiece in both graphically, sound design, and mostly world building. It was absolutely fantastic. I'll play a little bit of the sound of the trailer. That is, of course, if I can make it run on my Rodecaster. So this is what it sounded like. Here we go. See a beautiful water simulation of waves crashing against a scattered shoreline, small birds flying below you, forests that resemble the opening scenes of the movie Avatar.
Perished 1,000 years ago.
So this is about 1,000 years after our civilization.
Turned to graves. In their place came new life.
The robots are killing the natural life on the planet.
Until it destroys us all. There's nothing I wouldn't do to save this world. No depth I won't explore. No secret I won't unlock. No barrier I won't cross. This mission is mine alone. If I falter, if I fail, there won't be anyone left to stop what's coming.
Graphics look spectacular. As if you're watching a movie. Horizon Zero Dawn 2 Forbidden West.
But whatever comes.
Sound of big robotic mammoths, and it looks absolutely gorgeous. These big productions, has been in the making for years, probably. They're just as big, if not bigger, than some movie releases. This looks more gorgeous than most science fiction movies in theaters right now. That is why the gaming industry is such an integral part of our entertainment industry right now, and oftentimes these games make much more money than big Hollywood movies. And still, some people disregard it. It's just a video game. Well, it's not just a video game. It's like saying to a Rembrandt painting, it's just a painting. It's just a drawing. It doesn't work like that. Anyway, That is what I wanted to share with you. And then the final reveal at the end of the presentation was the actual hardware itself. Looks very futuristic, very sleek design. The opposite of the kind of boxy look of the Xbox. And that's probably on purpose. They want to make sure that the PlayStation is as different as possible, even though the innards are, you know, very comparable nowadays with the chipsets and graphics cards. But it looks really spectacular. And yeah, I don't know. They didn't talk about backwards compatibility, which is still one of the main assets, I think, of the Xbox. But this looks like something that may be on my list for Christmas. Who knows? Thanks for listening. This was another episode of Father Roderick to the Max. Hope you enjoyed it, and I'll be back next week. Thanks for your support.